I think Islam hates us.
They have done nothing except wreak havoc and terror for our faith and our religion.
When we stand up to those who oppress our communities, that Allah accepts from us that as a form of jihad.
Foundations of society are fragile. We must be the shepherds of our own civilization.
If anyone answers either yes or no without making necessary distinctions, both are not telling the truth. They're lying.
Father, we pray that your word will become a hammer that breaks rocks into pieces, that you will raise up in this nation pulpits and prophets that will call the nation back to repentance.
Will you distance yourself from those who think differently, or will you join us at the table and talk about what is really important? This is the Al-Ma'ida Initiative, conversation without compromise.
So tell me about the podcast. Did you just start that? Because I could swear I saw like a video version of that earlier, last year.
Oh, okay. In high school, I did radio with KUOW. So I was interning at KUOW doing the radio active program, and then in college and stuff like that, I was working on their Ask a series. So I was like always in and out of podcasting, in and out of radio, because I love journalism to that extent. And then this past year, I've always wanted to start my own podcast, like that's not connected to a brand or like an organization. And then I was working on one, and then Corona hit. I like got the trailer and everything ready, and then I was just like, it was just too much. And then I always have like these type of dialogues about like different topics and stuff like that with two of my close friends, Nathan and Cynthia. And I was like, oh my god, like you can just like start recording these, because like we're kind of so different. And like, although like we're all, well, Zaytun's mixed Oroma and Somali, but like although like we're all Somali, Zaytun's also not born in America, but like me is in this, well, like born and raised in America, like although we're so similar, we're also so different. So I was like, thought it was important to have a podcast that highlights that and like shows how you can unlearn and like look over your history, look over how you're taught things and how you can come to terms with it and stuff like that. So our podcast is called Disturbing Your Peace. So we look at different topics and we talk about how it disturbs our peace, but also how we preserve our peace and like come to terms with it. So like our first topic was patriarchy. We talked about like sexism and all things in the Somali Muslim community / American culture, how that like makes us go crazy some days and how we can come to terms with it. And then this week, tomorrow, we're posting about our American identity. So like how our peace is disturbed by being Americans. We talk about like, you know, traveling and how like ever since Trump became president, like people just like want to come at you like as an American, and like how different like groups of communities can't come to terms with that people can be American from all walks of life. So we're talking about how like so many times people come to you saying, where are you from? And then you have to like have this like battle with like, why can't I say I'm from Seattle, Washington without having to tell you where like my grandma and dad and mom were born in, like, because I'm born here, this is home. So that's like we were like talking about different topics. So like that's our podcast essentially.
And so what's your production process like? Like how long have you been working on this? Because I don't get to talk to people about this enough. So I've had my own journey with it.
Yeah, so I'm lucky because I know how to edit. So like I'm kind of like a trained sound engineer. So I edit on Adobe Audition. I can like cut and stuff like that. Zaytun does as well. So it's like nice to have two people on the team who like know how to mess with the sounds and like audio and all that. So that's nice. But like production. So first we each of us recorded separately because we were not staying together. So we each recorded separately. This is like before like the easing happened. And then it was just too much to edit because it was literally going to be like three people editing it, cutting it, making sure the voices sound the same. So we just decided to like record in person once a week. And like, I only trust them too because I know exactly where they go and who they interact with. And like, they promise, like they just stay home most, like all the time. So like we meet at our old Islamic school. They have a studio type thing. We're the only ones who use it. So we go there, we record, which is easier to record because like it's just all three of us sitting. So like, I honestly just like tune in the voices and stuff like that. I want to like edit more and like, you know, become more of a producer, like adding our own sounds and like our own like, you know, mixes and stuff like that. But like the girls are kind of like, oh, that sounds nice. Don't mess with it too much. But I want to like start like messing with it and like adding like crazy sounds. Cause a trailer, I had to have so much fun. If you listen to a trailer, you'll see like, it's just crazy. And I just like doing stuff like that.
Yeah. I can edit more than I do edit. But for now, we just kind of wanted a sort of Joe Rogan experience kind of vibe, which is very sort of unscripted and unproduced. Yeah. But basically my goal is to kind of do this for a year. And then once I've done it for a year, then I'm going to assess exactly the best format for it.
Okay, yeah, that's smart. Yeah, it takes a while. I think that you like create your own style. Like, I think that like it also depends what the listeners want. Like sometimes, like I'm an avid podcast listener. Sometimes I just like hearing the Joe Rogan, like the just unscripted version. Sometimes I do like the version, like the scripted versions, and I love the architect of that. But like, it just depends on your audiences, because like it'll be annoying if you sat there editing for an hour and you're super excited, and then people are like, "Yo, stop it! Like, go back to unscripted version." So it's good to like test it out as well.
Yeah, right. And some things lend themselves better to different formats. So getting close though. This is episode 41. So I have So I have basically I got like 9 weeks to go after this, and then I have a season finale. I actually managed to find the ex-wife of one of the highest ranking American members of ISIS, and that is my season finale, and I'm really excited about that.
That's insane. That's pretty tech.
Yeah. So it's been fun. It's really fun doing the podcast, because what I find in the Muslim world especially is that there are a lot of people who think about things a lot with like no one to talk to about it.
Yes, that's true. I can see that.
So yeah, it's
hard, because I think that like, I think like early 2010 to 2015 was peak. Everybody wanted to learn about Muslims. Like, people hated that Islamophobia was peak for me in my reality. And then now I feel like I think there's just too much stuff going on in the world that they forgot about. It's like, people still hate us, but they're just like, I got other like things to hate on. Like, you're not my focus right now.
Yeah. No, I definitely get a sense of that. That it's not a couple years ago when there were sort of bigger things happening in the news, there was far more people talking about this. And honestly, from my approach to it, that this kind of some of the right wing media, and some of them tend to paint a very one sided picture of Muslims, which is entirely negative.
Yeah.
But I think the counter reaction is from the Muslim community is almost to try and show too polished a narrative of how great the Muslim community is.
Yeah.
And it's not a compelling story to do that, right? I think compelling stories are about real people with good things about them, with bad things about them, and things to work on. And I really want to be about pushing people towards a more nuanced conversation about how this works. It's more human and enduring.
Yeah, I think for me, like, I just made a decision to, like, stop letting the media teach me about everyday people. Like, I have the ability to talk, walk. I can just, like, you know, meet individuals and, like, paint a picture for myself. Because I think it's, like, it's not productive to constantly watch the news, complain, oh, my God, they're showing a bad side of Muslims, they're showing bad side of Black people, they're showing bad side of, like, all people at that point. And then, like, you not educating yourself and actually, like, getting away from that narrative and figuring out, okay, like, who is this community? What do they do? And I think some people do that. Like, they try to engage with Muslims. They go to, like, interfaith dialogue. They go to the mosque during Ramadan for iftar and stuff like that, which is really productive, because, like, you meet, like, it's impossible to say that, you know, a group of, like, the second largest religion in the world don't have bad people. Like, I'll be the first to say I hate a lot of Muslims. Like, they piss me off. They piss me off. So it's like, I don't agree with the narrative that we're all perfect. We're not perfect. Nobody's perfect. But I think, like, outside of even the Muslim community, it's important to, like, engage with other people. Like, right now there's this narrative that, like, you know, all cops are bad, or like all white people are like pissing us off, and like we should hate them. I think that's, like, unproductive, and it's, like, disturbing, because, like, all cops are not bad. Nobody believes that. And I think that people should, like, figure out, like, why that narrative is out there, and, like, you know, engage with cops. For me, it's like I have a weird scope of the world, which is, like, what the other podcast is about. I don't really, like, do the news thing. I'm not on social media, so, like, if I meet somebody, they're amazing. I literally believe that, like, whoa, their community is the best thing in the whole wide world. Like, I don't think much of it. And even opposite, like, if somebody treats me bad, which happens quite often, I have anger management, so I get pissed off. but like I forget about it. Like I get pissed off. If you piss me off, James, like I will not think that all dreams are horrible or all white people are bad. I'll just think you're the worst person in the whole wide world, and I hate you, just you individually. So I think that like people just like are so like on social media all the time that they forget to like go out into the world and like talk to people. This is before COVID, but even with COVID, I think you can shoot people an email. You can like engage with their content, and I think people forget that social media, the algorithms are like super constrained to what you want to see. So a lot of times you're just seeing stuff you want to see. If you hate Muslims, the content you're engaging with is Islamophobic content. And if you like constantly are against reaching dialogue with any community, like LGBT community, all these communities, like your social media is literally just showing you what you want to see, and that's not how the world is. So for me, I got off social media, I left that world, and I just like engaged with the beautiful world God created, because God created us all equal for a reason. I think it's important that we engage with that and we come to terms with that, because I think sometimes you get pissed off because people are not, and I do this all the time, like I get so pissed off that people cannot humanize Black people or humanize Muslims or humanize people with disabilities, and I get really angry, but then I have to step back and figure out, you know, they're probably pissed at me for like having the same views. So how can we come to the middle term without them feeling like their values are, you know, being like compromised? The same with me. So it's like, it's a hard thing, but I think it's important for us to constantly be in that piece and thinking about it.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. I basically way upped my productivity during Rona by resolving to only listen to the news maybe twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so easy just to kind of get hooked on the constant cycle of outrage and drama that makes you very cleverly think that if you look away, if you're out of control of what's going on in the world, then bad stuff's going to happen, and you just got to get past that.
Yeah, especially like with when Rona was going on, like everybody was like super anxious, and like it was just so like draining, because like the news didn't have no answers. Like you would listen to these, you would watch it, and they would basically say, we don't know what's going on, like nobody knows what's going on, like see you tomorrow to talk about how horrible the world is and how horrible you are. It's just like I don't want to hear it. I really don't. I think that people forget to preserve their mental space and like mental peace for that, and like people start observing other people's businesses and like other countries' businesses sometimes. Like I think a lot of times I have a lot of European family members and friends in Europe, and I feel that a lot of times they're super like too connected about what's going on in America. And America, same with them, we care too much about what's going on in the Middle East. We're like, someday, turn off the news, look at what's going on in your four corners of the world, because it's probably not as good as you think they are. Like for me, it's like I just focus on like my community and the greater like Puget Sound, King County. Sometimes I just make it my four corners. It's like it's so important to just narrow down what you have control over. It's like I can change my family's life, I can change my community's life, I can't change the world. I can, but not really. You know what I mean? Like, let's be realistic.
Right. And if you are going to change the world, it's going to be by doing something productive where you live.
Literally.
Right. And then
that's where it starts.
Right. So what happens is, because we have more access to information than we have ever had, it makes it feel like every single problem in the world is our problem to solve, which then just feels paralyzing and depressing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Rather than breaking it down, it's like, okay, what's wrong with me today? What can I help improve about my family, my neighborhood, my city, right? And then maybe your country, and then maybe the world.
Mm-hmm.
But
It's like the opposite. People start from the world, then the country. And it's also like super easy, because like I think that social media and the media has literally controlled the world. We just care about what the media is pushing. So it's like when the 2 weeks that the media is talking about Black Lives Matter, that's the only time we care about Black Lives Matter. Once that's over, we go to the next issue. And it's like, we're literally not changing anything, because our attention spans can't grasp change, because like we want everything to change like this. It's like, it's just so toxic. Like I hate it. I've got to the point where it's like I'm numb to it, so I just cannot engage with, especially a lot of people my age are on social media. A lot of people my age are super like, they just tweet every day about what's going on in the world. I can't engage with this. It's like my friends know me. I turn it off the moment people are talking about issues in other countries. I don't know about it. It's just like, I'm not you. I don't want to engage in it. I want to talk about productive conversations. So like, yeah. Yep, I can see you. Yeah.
So I listened to the first episode of your podcast.
Okay.
So it from what the experience you guys are describing it sounds like a very interesting rock and a hard place in some ways. On the one hand, there seems to be an American culture saying, okay, you have to fit into this box in order to have a meaningful life. But then also the culture you've come out of is also saying you have to fit into this box in order to have a meaningful life. And you don't really fit into either. So what do you actually do with that? What do you do when you grew up not fitting in anywhere?
It's hard because, like, when I leave my house, like, my parents immigrated from Somalia. They speak Somali. They also speak English. My parents are super Americanized. They will never come to terms with it, but I think they're super Americanized. But when I'm home, my dad is constantly saying, you guys are not Somali. Don't claim Somalia. We don't want you all. You guys are American. You're super American. Blah, blah, blah. I leave my house. Amy or, like, a random white person's like, you're not American. You're definitely a pirate. Like, all these things. And it's like, what am I? Like, where do I fit in? And it's like, it's so hard because it's like, I do speak Somali. I understand the Somali culture a lot. But then, like, I'm born and raised here in America. So it would be impossible for me not to grasp and understand the American culture and, like, relate to it. And I think whenever I leave America, it shows how American I am. Like, it proves to me, like whatever people say, they're lying. I'm definitely American. Like, when I'm, like, when I go to Holland a lot, my dad's family lives there, it's, like, super American. Like, I'm tired of the public transportation. I just have first world problems. Like, I'm constantly quoting, like, oh yeah, back home we have this. And when I say back home, it's never Somalia. It's always what's going on in Seattle, Washington. So, like, it's hard. But for me, like, my experiences, I had a little identity crisis, like, high school, early college. And then I just came to terms with, you know what, like, both cultures might reject me, but I'm going to, like, mix them both and create my own, if that makes sense. Because I think for me, it's like, I speak English. I'm super aware of what's going on in my country, i.e. America. And I was in Utah one time, super random for a job interview. And my Uber driver was this old white guy. And we're just talking about our upbringing. And we just had so much in common, from shows we watched, like, foods we eat, like, even, like, although he's an ex-Mormon and a Muslim, like, just on how we thought about faith and all these things. And I was like, from the outside looking in, nobody would think we would have so much in common, but we do. And I think, like, that just shows. And, like, even, like, the other side, it's like, I speak Somali, but sometimes I have a huge disconnect with my mom or my grandma, because, like, we didn't grow up in the same area and, like, the same side of the world, or, like, you know, our values are different. And it's a lot of like, not fighting, but a lot of arguments, because, like, an issue will come up and then I'll just respond to it. I'm like, mom, what do you think? Da da da. Mom will know. And I'm like, what do you mean no? Like, it's this, that. And then, like, sometimes I'm right and sometimes she's right. And sometimes it's like, I think my mom's wrong. And then, like, when the media or somebody says this way of thinking, I'm like, oh, my mom used to always say that. I didn't know she was that. Like, you just, as a kid, you never think your mom's right. So I think, like, it's hard. It's a constant battle. But I think a lot of, like, child of immigrants or, like, people who come from two different cultures, they just mix it. You create your own culture. And I think as you get older, you just, like, come to terms with it. Like, some days I feel super Somali. And those days usually happen when I call my grandparents and I'm forced to speak Somali only to them because they don't speak English. And then some days I feel super American. But I think as time goes by, it's more of a mix. It just depends how I'm feeling. And some days I don't feel nothing. I'm just Muslim. Like, I'm just on a whole, like, spiritual thing where I'm like, yep, this Islam thing is for me. And, like, other days I'm just nothing. So it just depends on the vibe, but it's hard. It's hard. It's super, it's not easy. It's two cultures telling you, we do not accept you. Leave us alone. Stop claiming us at all times.
Yeah. Well, I resonate with what you're saying with the Mormon taxi driver and having all the sort of shows, because honestly, I found my home hasn't ever really felt like anywhere I've lived. Like, I never felt like I fit in in England. Mm-hmm. I feel like I fit in slightly more here than I did at home, but mm-hmm. only with a sort of nerd culture.
Yeah.
So, and you'll make connections with people everywhere mm-hmm. because of that. So mm-hmm. I'm a huge Dragon Ball fan, and that makes me friends from every culture and surprisingly more age ranges than you think, right?
Yeah.
So there's this.
The way it goes, I think that they're like, it's, I always talk about this, like, community and home means so much. For me, like, it literally, like, it depends on time of the year. So whenever it's Christmas, like, if I'm not in Holland, I feel so out of place because, like, Christmas time, Holland is home and, like, I'm always around family. Like, it's so weird because it's like when I see somebody speaking Dutch, I get overly excited. I know like three words in Dutch, like it's never that serious, but I get super excited because I'm like, oh, you're from the Netherlands, you know what I mean? And I have that connection with them. And then like when I go to Minnesota, I feel so at home because like my culture's still out there. But then like Seattle's home. I think like it's all about your spirit. And I think God created us with the conscious spirit that allows us to feel at home other than places. Like I never, like Seattle is home, but I always have a constant battle with it because like I feel more at home with other parts of the world. You know what I mean? So it's like, it just depends. I think it's just the connections you build with people. Like for me, it's like, I can go to Minnesota and go kick it with old Somali heads and literally like have the most draining day of my life. Like this, like I do not relate to them at all. I don't know what they're saying half the time. I don't even speak the same dialect as them. And I can hang out with Steve from Utah, like have a good day. Like we're best friends our whole life. So I think like, and like, even when I went to England for the first time in my adulthood last winter. I was like creeped out. I was in London. I was kind of creeped out because I was like, there's a lot of Muslims. It feels like a Muslim country. Like I felt more in a Muslim country than I did in London than I did in Dubai. When I went to Dubai, I felt so out of place because I was so excited to celebrate Eid in a Muslim country. Was really overdoing it.
Oh, no, it's not. Like when I went to Dubai, I landed at like 11 p.m. And then, so I had the airport, the rental car place, the freeway, and the hotel. You would not know that you've left America.
Literally in America, and you might hear the call to prayer, depending on how they're feeling that day. Like, I was there on Eid, and, like, I was just super excited to celebrate Eid in a Muslim country. Like, I love Eid. Like, obviously, like, growing in America, Eid's not a thing. So the taxi driver was annoyed with how excited I was. So I was like, what are you doing? He's like, we just pray and we go out to eat. Like, what else is there to do? And he's, like, getting aggravated at my excitement. And I was like, this is a Muslim country. I was like, this is bogus. When I went to London, like, people were just like overly Muslim there. Everything was halal, like food wise. Obviously, everything in Dubai is halal, but it was just different because like London's not a Muslim country. So I found it so like fascinating that like I can go to any takeout spot and it's like it was probably going to be halal like almost all the time. KFC was halal, like Shake Shack was halal. All these things were mind blowing for me. Like I was like, what? Am I in a fake Muslim world? Like I just got like, you know what I mean? But like Dubai is a Muslim country. I still don't think. It's a Muslim country, but I didn't feel like it was a Muslim country because I was like, people were just looking at me like, you're overdoing this Muslim thing, not that deep. Like, you know, in their community, being Muslim is normal. And I was just like, whoa, it offended me.
Well, so I have actually noticed this, that it's almost that people who are second generation almost care more about their culture than their parents do a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Because it's like, because with a lot of parents, like, okay, screw this place, we're going to America. Whereas, you know, when you're striving to figure out who you are and what your family history is, then you're trying to figure out, okay, but what about this? What about this? What about this? Like, what do you care? Why yeah. is it important to you?
Yeah. Also, I think that, like, our parents and people who immigrated here, like, yeah, they said screw you, but, like, for Somali culture, they don't talk about all the bad things about their culture. So, like, when you talk to my parents and my grandparents, they just tell you, a nice painted picture of Somalia. They don't talk about... out of nowhere, they'll say two or three things. They're like, well, that's scary. When did that happen? And they just, like, shut down. They don't want to talk about it. But also, like, for them, I think they made their own communities. Like, a lot of times, like, some older Somali parents, like, they look at Somali news. They go to Somali shops. They go to Somali mosques. Like, they're in such a filled Somali community that they don't feel like they need to get out. Like, my parents don't eat at non-Somali establishments. I try to make them do it, and it's always a hot mess because my mom – swears that like Somali rice is the best and like Sharif Yusufi anywhere, but like for us is that like yeah we care so much about our culture, but we're also like super fascinated about other cultures. So it's like if I'm vegan now, but before I was vegan, it's like I'm eating at a Thai joint and it's halal chicken, I'm having like the time of my life, whereas my parents are still gonna eat tofu because they don't trust this establishment to actually cater halal food. So it's like it's two different worlds.
The funny thing is mentioning that, whenever I go to Chick-fil-A, I see Somalis now. And because I don't think there's ever like a ruling on this, but because Chick-fil-A is known to be run by Christians, everyone yeah. goes to Surah Al-Ma'idah, which is permissible for you as the food of the Allah Kitab, the people of the book. And people are using that as justification to eat a Chick-fil-A.
It's so funny because it's like, I'm like, is Chick-fil-A halal? And like that one person, no, they're super Christian. They're closed on Sundays. Like even Sundays is closed. And like, do you see their stance? Like they're super conservative. And I'm like, you do not like what? It's like how do the kitabs like so emphasized, I think, in the West. Like, I get it. Like, when I see things that are kosher, I get excited because I know I can eat it. And I think only Abrahamic steaks maybe get it. Like an average Joe eating at the site kosher joint does not care it's kosher. But a Muslim, it's a game changer. I can eat meat. So I think it's funny. It's like things that get us excited as like Muslims in the West or like Somalis in the West, it's like so weird. Like, it's like, make it like, it'd just be weird. Like, people will never get it. Like, you scan the halal thing and the gummy worms are halal. That is, it's just unreal. That feeling, knowing that the gummy worms, there's no pork, is top 10, like top 10 feeling in the world.
Yeah. So I'm curious, right? You talk about your parents only kind of talking about the good things about Somali culture, but I'm curious for you growing up in it, what are the things that you love about Somali culture?
I think for me it would be, it's weird. So like, my parents are super practicing Muslims. So like, growing up, I didn't grow up, I would say, in a Somali household. I just grew up in a Muslim household. Like, my parents emphasized like Islam and like taught me Islamic history and like taught me the importance of like being a good human to the world. And at the time I never got it, but now I got it, because I think a lot of times people get raised as like Somali nationals and like they like have a sense of pride and they feel like they're better than everybody else. Whereas like, my parents just like did not teach me that at all. Like, I knew I was Somali. I went to a predominantly Somali farm school. I like learned the language and stuff like that. But the thing that I really, like, so a lot of times, like, things that I emphasize in Somali culture is Muslim culture. And it's like, a lot of times it's intertwined for me and for a lot of Somali Americans, I'd say. But for me, like, I like how family oriented Somali culture is. Like, I remember growing up, like, we'll see a Somali auntie waiting at the bus stop and like, my mom would stop and be like, oh, we can take you. So that aspect of it. Or like, when we're at Safeway and like a Somali uncle or auntie need translation, like, it's never like, oh yeah, sure, I can help you. It's always like, they always like, they're super helpful in that. Like, the concept of being family oriented and like culture, like it's like a community is huge in Somali community. So I like that aspect. I like the I think the other aspect that I like is how nomadic Somali people are, even in the 21st century. Like, we literally migrated everywhere. So every, like, you can travel, I feel like, anywhere in the world and you might find a Somali person. It's like super fascinating to me. So I like how diverse it is, especially on like social media. You see a lot of young people from like Norway, Sweden, like, you know, English Somalis, and then you have the American, you have the Canadians. Like, we're all so different yet so similar. So I find that so beautiful. And I think that if the Somali world never happened, like, we would not have those type of experiences. So those things that are really like close to home, I would say our food is good, but if you have allergies like me, you can't eat it. So like, I grew up eating it, and then in adulthood God said, nope, you're allergic to it. So the food's really, really nice. I like that aspect. I also like how Somalis are just like loud people. Like, I'm super loud and bubbly and like funny, and I think it came from my Somali side. Like, Somali people are the funniest people in the whole wide world. I truly believe it. I think that people need to start understanding that. Like, we are so funny. Like, I never laugh as much if I'm not with Somalis, and I find that really, I think it's super biased of me to say, but we're just so funny. And like, our language, like, if you look at the things we say, the noises we make, like, it's like so insane, like, and funny. And I'm like so grateful that I know Somali language. Like, my two younger brothers don't know Somali, and I feel really bad for them because they never will understand jokes. Like, when you translate a Somali joke, it just doesn't make sense. I feel bad that they're never able to like grasp it. So those are the things I like hold dear about the Somali culture. And now growing up, I kind of understand the importance of understanding those as well.
So that would be something that is a surprise to me. Although when you think about it, I think about my own culture and England's humor, I think a lot of British humor has come through as a coping mechanism to get through very difficult times in history. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if that's something to do with Somali humor as well. But how well do you think you have to get to know Somalis before you realize that about them, that they're funny and have a sense of humor?
I think it just depends. So it's like, I have like ajnabi friends, which is non-Somali friends. And I think it just depends on like, if a non-Somali person is super nice, super kind, like one of my close friends, David, she's African American. She's like my sister. So she like comes over, like, we don't feel like we have to be awkward. Like, oh yeah, this is that. Like, I think that like sometimes like Somalis feel super awkward about their culture around others. Like, it's hard to explain to people, but I just feel like if they feel like you have a good sense of heart and you're not going to judge them too much, they will let you in. So I think you'll get the humor. Like, they're funny. Like, just like hanging out with them, you'll understand that their grasp of the world is a bit different. And like, I think though, sometimes art humor is pretty problematic. Like, woke culture can really like cancel us for good. I know like a lot of like celebrities and like people get canceled every day on Twitter, and I think Somalis like definitely can get canceled. We just have weird things of explaining things and the way we say things. It's just funny, and like they don't really, it's dark humor. Like, I think for me, I watch a lot of like British, like television, British shows, and I think it's because you all have dark humor and Somalis do too, so it's nice. Americans don't have that. That's something we can work on. Our humor is so bad here in the States, like it's actually sad. But like Somalis are funny.
Yeah, to be honest with you, I think that's one of the main things missing from race relations in this country, is that the way people tend to approach it in America is so sullen and serious. Mm-hmm. And that in my mind, one of the best things about hanging out with people from different cultures is how funny it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the side of woke culture where, you know, okay, when you're around this, you say this and this and this and this, and you can't say this, right? The ironic thing about that is it's a very white sort of Victorian manner way of doing things, and doesn't really represent most of the world.
Yeah.
So it's this really strange paradox of, you know,
I also think that woke culture removes like the sense of like just having fun. Like, people constantly have to feel like they're walking on eggshells, and it's like mm-hmm. not fun. For me, it's like, I'm like anti woke culture, like, because I hate social media so much. Like, sometimes even when I'm with some of my friends and stuff like that, I think a lot of young people are just super like, in Somalia, I would say they drink up like woke culture. Like, they have a bottle that's labeled woke culture, and they drink it, and like every day they see the world from this lens, and they're super critical. And I just think that's too much energy. Like, have a laugh. Like, if somebody, a white person says a funny joke, I'm going to laugh. I don't think they mean it. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's the thing that constantly, like, I don't want to live in fear. Like, oh my God, am I saying the right thing? Am I obviously, like, you know, like, don't like harm people and like make horrible jokes that are quote unquote racist and all these things. But I think like, if you're around Somalis and you're super intrigued, like, why do you do that? Just ask them. Like, don't be like, oh my God, they're going to cancel me. They're going to tell me that I'm wrong and I'm racist. It's not that serious. I think it's good to have a laugh. I think sometimes it's good to like be honest. I'm that one friend who always says things everybody's thinking, but people are scared to say out loud. I'm just gonna tell you, because I'm like, I'm wondering, like, why do you think this way? I remember like a week ago, the Oromia and Ethiopia conflict are like really peak right now, but I wasn't on social media, so I didn't understand how peak it was. And like, I just felt like every time, like, it was Eritrea and Somalia Independence Day, like, people made us feel bad for having an Independence Day. So I honestly wanted to know what my Oromo friends felt about it. And I asked them, and they were like, oh, wow, I didn't see that people felt this way. And it was a nice, productive conversation. And it was pretty funny, too, because I was just like, oh, I'm just trying to enjoy July 1st. I don't really celebrate it, but I'm just trying to, you know, post without feeling guilty that others don't have their Independence Day. Like, what is it about? It's like, it was a productive conversation. It was pretty funny. We kept it moving. It wasn't that deep. If I didn't have that conversation, like, I would always feel some type of way every time I tweeted about their injustice. I was like, I didn't tweet a heck of hard on July 1st. It's my day to celebrate my Independence Day. Not that deep, we got over it, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think in my mind, one of my philosophies behind Almeida, right, because as well as the podcast, we regularly get Christians and Muslims to dinner, is that the simple truth is that if you're constantly worried about offending somebody, that person is not your friend, right? Friends are people you can be honest with, and people you can kind of relax around. And if the whole paradigm we have for relationship between different ethnicities and culture is, okay, I don't want to mess up, then you actually never make any progress to helping people cross cultural lines to make friends. You just put people in a perpetual state of fear that, you know, when the media says to behave one way, they'll behave that way because they're afraid. But then that fear will eventually turn into resentment and just start this awful cycle over again.
Yeah, I think that, like, nowadays, that, like, there's just such a huge polarization. There's a huge divide. You can literally see on, like, every Western country, like, there's a clear, like, oh, you're a liberal, I'm a conservative. We will not communicate with each other. We hate each other. And I think a lot of Somalis who live in Seattle struggle with that because, like, obviously we're Muslim. We have a lot of conservative views on things. And then, like, there's a huge liberal culture that's constantly fighting for us. but then also making it feel uncomfortable for seeing people at faith. So it's like super awkward because like, yeah, like I'm probably liberal because I'm born and raised in Seattle. Like I have a lot of Democratic views, but then like, those views kind of make me feel some type of way because like, I don't know, Seattle has this weird culture of making people of faith feel out of place. It's like, because I believe in a higher power, I'm the problem. Like, you should go to Texas. You're the problem. You know what I mean? It's weird. And then like, as Somalis, it's just awkward for us because it's like, ooh, like, thanks for fighting for me. Thanks for telling me my life matters. But you don't give a F about my religion. You hate my God. Like, this is awkward. You know what I mean? So I think that the way the world is going, it's like so like problematic, and I'm really scared for it because I don't want to live in a world where if I say the wrong thing, like I'm canceled for life, you know, or like if somebody says, that's why for me, like I have a lot of guy friends because I feel like guys are more chill. Like guys, everybody's their friend. You just play video games, you play basketball, you say a few laughs, it's not that serious. And I think like a lot of girls, especially like Black Muslim girls, because they're constantly at a battle to prove their livelihood and prove their innocence to the world, and constantly the world's justifying them, and they're like, it's overwhelming. I think a lot of times they're just like, say one word and I'm ready to fight, and it's like, bro, it's not that deep. Like, calm down, like have a laugh, like live a little. I think I wish more people seen that, especially with COVID. Like, you should not be super negative and super like constantly talking about big issues in the world. And like with faith, I think like I have a lot of Christian friends, and I just wish people of faith understood that during these times, like, just being a person of faith is already hard, so we shouldn't divide ourselves. Like, if you're a Christian, cool story, bro. We can relate on some things. If you're Jewish, cool story, bro. Like, I don't understand why people would be like, oh, I hate you, you're Muslim, I'm Christian. Like, my way of life is better. I just find that awkward. Like, even now, like, that I grew older, like, people do this at church. People do, like, mosques, like, just promote this, like, where Muslims are better than everybody else. And I'm like, cool, I get it. You got to feel good about yourself. But it's like, you live in Seattle, 95% of the people hate you for being a person of faith. Might as well like the 5% of you who believe in God. I just don't get why Christians and Muslims in Seattle have an issue. I'm just like, everybody in the city hates you. Get along. Like, fight it out.
Right, right, right. So, yeah, you've got this place where people kind of symbolically like you, but then once they actually get to know you, it's like, eh, really?
Yeah. Like, whenever you, like, if you say, like, I'm a person of faith, I'm obviously going to talk about, like, God. I'm going to talk about, you know, I'm just going to say, like, no, thank God, or, like, I'm just going to say things that, like, you know, in Islam, or, like, it's common because this is what I believe in. And they're just like, you can see that, let's switch the topic. Like, let's move on. I'm fighting for your livelihood, but I don't want to, like, know the reality of it. It's like, how do you want to fight Islamophobia, but you deep down hate Muslims? Like, it's like the concept of religion. I don't get it. It's weird. It's like, I think that, like, I hated, like, in high school, all my teachers were agnostic and all my teachers were atheists, and they constantly made me feel awkward for being Muslim. And because I was young, I didn't understand that was illegal for them to do so. But I remember one of my teachers, he literally said, when you go to college, you will become like an atheist and agnostic. And if you don't, that shows that you didn't really learn anything, and that like being a person of faith shows that you're dumb. And I remember I was so angry that he said that. I was so offended, and I just didn't understand why. But now, like, I'm like, it's never that serious. Like, I didn't judge you for, you know, believing what you believe in. Like, why was it so much harsh reality for mine?
Well, I think what it is that growing up in Seattle, people don't realize that they have a worldview, right? They think, I don't have a worldview. I'm just a normal, empathetic human being, and I'm a good person, right? But they don't know how they define good. They don't really know where their worldview came from. So what they assume, right, is that most Muslims or most Christians believe the exact same things that they do, or you're an extremist.
Yeah.
And it's because there's no reflection on their own worldview, right? So, and but that happens in societies with a monolithic view, right? Whereas you and I, living in places where our views are in the minority, it forces us to be able to think, okay, why do I believe what I believe? Why do I think this is good? Why do I think this is bad? And what do I base that in? Whereas somebody who just grows up in a context, so it's like, okay, well, good people are this way, bad people are this way. And it, and that happens in religious countries as well, but it happens when people are not forced to think about why they believe what they believe.
Yeah. And it's awkward when you ask them why they think the way they think, because they like can't. Whereas you ask a Muslim why you wear the hijab, like, I was waiting for this day to come, got the facts, got the proof. I also think that's a weird way of living. Like, you should learn your faith and religion for your own good, not to just have an argument with people. So I think both parties are just suffering. It's just like, have it easy, mate. It's not that deep.
So I'm curious for you, how your faith does play into your life, right? Because clearly you're somebody who is navigating between lots of obstacles, right? You're resisting some things in the sort of woke culture, but you're also resisting things in your own culture, and you're resisting some things in some more mainstream culture. So for you, where do you find your kind of information and so your sort of like your, I guess, your foundation for the decisions you make personally?
I think I would say faith, Islamically. Like I, growing up, I think the biggest value my parents gave me was integrity and always doing the right thing that you felt was right. So like, I think that like, I don't know, I always see like Muslims, non-Muslims always taking the shortcut and like doing things that they know is not morally correct. And that just does not sit right with my spirit. Like I always find that weird. Like when people do take shortcuts or like they cheat and stuff like that, that doesn't feel right with my spirit. So I think like, I always like look into like what's the right thing to do, and the way I look into that is like I look Islamically, like what does Islam say? I think for me, I get the most peace and ease when I learn about different things that Islam says, about different topics and how to treat people. And like, I think Islam is so perfect. I think all religion is perfect, but people just F it up and mess it up. So for me, it's like I really don't fit into any mosque in the area. Like I don't claim like this is my mosque, like this is home, this is community. I did, but my mosque closed down. So it's like ever since my mosque closed down, I was in this like weird bubble where I felt like I had to find a new mosque or a new community to fit in. And that didn't work out because I think that like, I just think I'm just complicated. Like God literally made my life, like just the way I think about things complicated. Like, yeah, I'm Muslim, but I also have liberal values. I have a liberal way of thinking. I also think that you shouldn't treat anybody like trash. And I think a lot of times, like a lot of communities and faiths feel like they have to like justify that they're greater than others. And it's just like, I don't get it. So like for me, I find my peace by like learning about Islamic history, like learning about what the Prophet used to do, like in different things and stuff like that. I also think it's important for people to learn their faith by just own research. Like I think it's weird. I think that like a lot of faith groups are super focused on like learning from the sheikh, straight from the sheikh, learning from the pastor. And I think we forget that they have their own biases, and a lot of times the way they communicate different things is from their own lenses. And I think in the Muslim community, a lot of sheikhs and a lot of people of knowledge, quote unquote, are men. And I'm just a male hater, quote unquote, because I'm a feminist. It's like a lot of times, like when they say things, I'm like, I don't know about that. Like, how did you come to that conclusion? Because I could say the opposite. So for me, it's like I do my own research. I also go to like a lot of like, well, I used to. I think I just like have been having. I just woke up one day and I said I'm not going to be in any Muslim mosque community. So I rarely now go to any like lectures, but I do listen to lectures from like people I support and stuff. So I think that like being a conscious Muslim is my goal, and being more spiritual. Like I don't want to be more religious. I think that like faith is perfect, and I think being spiritual, you're able to glimpse it. I think for me, religious people are not really religious. It's just a lot of ego. So it's like you see a lot of like practicing proud Christians who just want the world to think they're good people because of that title without actually doing the work. And same with Muslims. Like, so for me, it's like I don't want to be a religious person because the religious people I see are like internally, like not, they don't have integrity, they're not good people. You know what I mean? Like the people I observed and stuff like that. And like, I just don't like how unjust they are to other communities. So I think that like being a Muslim, being a conscious Muslim requires me to be aware of my privileges, requires me to be aware of how I can help other communities and how I can promote unity instead of division. Because I think that like, I think Islam was sent to unite the world and not like divide it. Like obviously, like I'm not saying everybody needs to be a Muslim. That's never gonna happen. Like, God created Muslims and non-Muslims for a reason, but I think it's important for us to understand one another and like live in harmony. And I always like want to understand how I can make that possible, and my four corners are like, you know, just like little things. I think for me it's like I think I just want to be more conscious for sure.
So kind of on that note, I was listening, something you were talking about in the podcast is, you know, you'll hear something about how women should act specifically, and someone will always come with kind of a bunch of hadiths, and then what you'll be doing is then you'll have done your own research and you'll have your own quotes. So how do you personally kind of figure out, okay, this part of the tradition, I think this is right. And I think these other parts are being twisted. So how do you personally figure out, okay, what's what in that? Because I know that's a challenge a lot of people have.
Yeah. For me, I think that me and a lot of my close friends were like literally born and raised in an Islamic school. So like a lot of the same, I have a hands up on this. It's like, I've been to Islamic school for like 10, 12 years of my life. I was able to like learn and like study the faith and like understand, I think like we call it aqidah, but like the foundation, my foundation of Islam is really strong because like I have Islamic school teachers and teachers who like were so like, I just, sometimes when I think about it, I'm like, they're just such amazing people. And like, they taught me the good aspects of the religion and not like the aspects that like the media plays around with or like a lot of shaykhs just like mess around with. So like growing up, I always thought like, you know, Islam is a religion that promotes women's rights, but you know, Islam is a religion that promotes knowledge and like, you know, technology and like science, and like Islam is a religion that just is like, I was able to understand Islamic history a lot. So it's like when I do go to like a lot of these like ethnic community messages and stuff like that, and like they're saying different things, I kind of question it, but then I know what lecture, and my parents also understand the religion a lot as well. So I can ask my parents, I can ask different sheikhs and stuff like that. So I don't just like go on Google and have fun and like figure out Islam on my own. I like try to do my own research, because I think a lot of times like people go to like a lecture and like listen to it and literally believe everything this person said. I think it's important to be critical, and I think it's important to be like, okay, where do you get this? Where do you get this way of learning? What are the other what are the other opinions, and what are the other things that other sheikhs are saying? So a lot of times like this, a lot of chefs will just come in, say their piece, and they be like, oh, by the way, I totally forgot to tell you that, like, everybody rebuttals my way of thinking. And I think this, and I'm, like, a minority on this topic, you know what I mean? And I think that, like, a lot of times, like, a lot of young Muslim men, like, have some type of fetish to study Islam. And then to do so, I think that they just think that, like, being sexist is being a Muslim. So it just doesn't sit right with my spirit, because I'm like, how are you promoting sexism and then claiming to be, this is what Islam says, because, like, when I look at this side of it, some, I don't see it. But I think, like, I was always critical growing up. And I think that's what Islam school taught me, was to constantly being critical. And, like, and I think it was important because I'm a post-9/11 baby. So, like, my whole childhood, which I wasn't aware of, people were constantly coming at Muslims and constantly justifying, questioning our faith. So I think it was so important for me to do the same thing. Because, as you said, like, if people ask me anything about my religion, most times I'm able to answer because I was able to ponder, research, understand why do I think the way I think, who thinks like me, and why do they think that as well. And I think my parents hate it, because like I'm constantly up there, like I'm just like, actually that's not right, this is what I believe in, this is what I, but they give me that ability to think. I think a lot of parents just like want their kids to think the way they think. That's not healthy. Like, let your kids like have a different aspect of faith in you is important, and that's what I like to do. Sorry, my headphones just fall off.
Yeah, I think that you have this, there's lots of different issues that come from this underlying issue of, okay, don't ask questions, just trust the scholars. But that mindset is so pervasive that it underlies, I think, a great deal of the issues in the Muslim world. That If you just have to take the word of the village sheikh for, you know, what you believe in, and if you go look at it yourself and say, no, you're not qualified to understand this, then that's how you enshrine problems in a society, right? Mm-hmm. Is by disparaging people from speaking up. So in the Bible, there's this principle Jesus gives that he says, call no man on earth teacher, because you have one teacher, the Messiah, speaking about himself. In the principle he's talking about there is that ultimately you're responsible for your understanding of God, and that no one else, right, not a single scholar is going to stand in front of God with you and give an account for your life, right? That's just something that you do. So if you're the one who has to give an account to God for your life, you can't delegate that to, okay, well, the imam told me this, or my uncle told me this, therefore, I believe that.
And Islam also has aspects of that. I think when you hit puberty, like, you have to do your own research and figure out if this is the faith for you. So we believe like you're born a Muslim, and then when you hit puberty, you make that decision to continue being Muslim. So I think like Islam has that too. I think throughout history, like people were always critical, and like people would always ask, cause, like, you can't go to the Day of Judgment and be like, I don't know, God, this guy told me I'm supposed to do that. And that's what I never questioned. I just went with it. Like, how do you assume this person doesn't make mistakes, or their way of thinking, you know, justifies it? But also, like, I understand how problematic, because I feel like sometimes people, like, try to do their own research without having the right lenses, or, like, understanding it's not an accurate source, or, you know, all these little things, and, like, come up with, like, skewed way of thinking, like, Islamically. I think it's important to, like, do your research, but also, like, maybe fact-check and, like, have discussion with scholars, or, like, you know, like, watch a lot of content that's out there about, like, different, like, scholars. I also think it's important for you to, like, for me, like, the struggle I have in a lot of mosques is that people just have a uniform culture. I'm not sure if it's like that in churches, but there's a way of, everybody thinks that you have to think the same, you have to respond, you have to believe the same thing about everything, you have to look the same, you have to dress the same, and that's how, what we call Muslims in our mosque. And I find that weird, because I think that, like, God created us all different for us to look and think the same, or God, like, you know, dress the same, or, like, there's going to be an outlier. But I just don't like how the Muslim community, like, makes you feel like an outlier, and, like, just because you didn't follow the sheikh, it's, like, you're done for. It's, like, we're all coming at you, like, you're the problem, get the F off the mall. You know what I mean? It's just weird. It's, like, bro, I just didn't listen to him on this one topic. Like, he's still a cool dude. I just don't agree with him on this. And I told him why I don't agree with it. He's cool with it. Why are you mad? So I just wish that, like, people of faith allowed critical thinking to exist, and, like, normalized it, and didn't make people who think about things or question things, like, feel like outliers. Because I feel like they're the ones who are going to make the change, not they're the ones who are going to actually follow the faith. Because these people who just have this little uniform culture, like, I think a lot of people just love this, have a fetish of being called people of faith, and, like, religious, like, all these fancy words, but they don't do the work, they don't do it. So,
well, it's ironic in some ways, because the Muhammad himself was the first one to think the way he thought in the place he was living, right? So in theory, Muslim culture should celebrate individualism, and, you know, at least as far as being willing to sort of think on a different trajectory than everyone else is. I find British culture the same, actually. That's one thing I love about being in America, is that I think British people in general don't like new ideas until they're already successful. And they're like, oh yeah, we always like this. Whereas in America, people are far more willing to try things. And I like that.
Mm-hmm. That's the funny thing. So it's like, as an American Muslim, I hate British Muslims sometimes. Because they have that weird, they're pissing me off. I can literally go on around how much British Muslims piss me off. But they have that thing where, like, if somebody's doing something different, or, like, there's a Muslim activist out there, they just have to, like refute them, and, like, just come at them, and, like, they just have this weird thing of saying, no, but the moment, like Black Lives Matter, for instance, a lot of, like, British Muslims and, like, conservative Muslims, they're like, oh, we can't say that, it's not Islamic to say that, we're not going to go against it, our mosque will not be saying that, we're not going to be talking about that. 2 weeks ago, when it became, like, mainstream, British Muslims were like, Black Lives Matter, they're promoting it, they're tweeting it, I was like, you're just waiting for this to go mainstream, you can never be the leaders in anything, like, and I think that maybe it's British culture, but a lot of British Muslims and some conservative Muslims just wait for things to be mainstream, or, like, society is okay with it, for them to come out and accept it. And I think that's just, like, super problematic, like, Islamically speaking, because I think Muslims were always the leaders of the world. Like, if you look at Islamic history, like, even Prophet Muhammad, like, the stuff he said was so strange that, you know, his society, like, it took so much years for them to come to terms with it. So I don't understand why Muslims now can't grasp that. There's a lot of follower culture going on.
Well, I think I think a big part of it, right, is if you look at the Islamic Golden Age, there was a school of thought called the Mu'tazilites, and coinciding with them, there's this idea of ijtihad, this idea of, like, the struggle of the mind. But then towards the end of the Islamic Golden Age, people decide, okay, all the major questions are settled, and it's not your job to do ijtihad anymore. The idea is taqwa, right? That, okay, you just find, because all the questions have been solved, you just find a scholar to imitate and copy that person, rather than wrestling through it yourself.
Yeah.
And so you've always had this battle in the Muslim world of people who want to really do the work of wrestling with the material, and the people who are saying, no, don't ask questions, find someone to copy and just listen and go about your life.
Yeah. I think that's weird. I also think that, like, the whole notion of, like, finding one person to listen to is, like, super weird. Like, for me, it's like, I'm not even saying, like, come up with new ways of thinking, like, asking any questions. I'm just figuring out why do you think that, you know, we can be homophobic? Like, you know what I mean? Like, why do you think that person can be homophobic? That's not, like, you know, I think that's not okay because of this. Or, like, you just said something that's super ableistic. Like, you know, why are you using that word? And, like, it's, like, little things. And I think that, like, people are like, nope, don't question the chef. He's right. But I'm like, I'm sorry, but in this aspect, the chef was wrong because he's saying something that's wrong and is offending millions of people. I think it's important for us to, like, engage in dialogue to figure out why he thinks the way he thinks. And also, and then a lot of times, like, for my example, it's, like, a lot of times the people of knowledge or the people I'm questioning, they're okay with the dialogue. It's their followers who are like, nope, you may not question this man. This man is so knowledgeable. How dare you disrespect him? And it's, like, I'm literally just asking him. It's like a professor. You just said all this information. I'm trying to figure out what's true, what's not. How can I come to terms with it? And it's, like, I can't even ask you a question now. Like, that's weird.
Yeah, you know, you what you're describing is, I think, is common, that people are not willing to look at truth because they want certainty, right? They just want to be comfortable. And the quest for truth is always more difficult than that, because sometimes the truth can take you to some places that are comfortable, right? Because if you go on a quest for God and your conclusion is, wow, God is exactly like me. He loves the things I like and hates the things I hate. It's like, wow, how convenient, right?
Yeah. It's like, also, I feel like they don't grow that way. Like, with our podcast, which is why, like, we kind of, like, wanted to talk about, like, different things that we had to struggle and, like, grasp. But I think that, like you said, a lot of people think that they just want to find a religion, or they just want to find a God that's, like, just like them and their way of thinking. But I think that's not what faith is. I think faith is important to grasp and, like, struggle. Like, the concept of struggle is so important in faith, because I think that's when your faith grows, and that's when you, like, truly feel the love of God, and that's when you're like, you know, I truly believe there's a higher power because this, that. But if you're constantly comfortable and you're just going to the mosque, doing your nap, like, every day thinking, like, it's not conscious. Like, I remember this Ramadan, I was like, in the first half, I was telling my ustad, I was like, yeah, it's cool and all, but I just feel like I'm in a routine, like, it's repetitive. Like, I'm not actually feeling the act I'm doing. He was like, well, you should, like, you know, figure out what's wrong and, like, you know, actually, like, talk to your nefs about, like, how can you actually, like, feel like Ramadan is changing you. And once I started doing it, understanding, like, to look into, well, okay, this is why I pray, this is why I do the way I do, you just become more consciously aware and you, like, feel more connected. But if I was to just sit there and, like, was like, well, everybody's doing Ramadan this way, I'm certain this is how Ramadan's supposed to go, I would have not felt more connected and felt spiritually, you know, better at the end of Ramadan. I think a lot of times people are just super scared of the unknown. And I hope Rona taught them the unknown. It's bad, but, like, there's good things come out of it if you keep fighting for it. So,
yeah. And all the Rona did is it showed us that we're always living on the unknown, right? That any kind of stability and routine is a very... it's a very thin illusion in some ways, that your life can change in a moment, always.
Mm-hmm. And that, I feel like Ron has taught a lot of people that. I feel like, I don't know, for me, I think it showed me that God is so in control. Like, the fact that I was able to just shut down the world, the whole world, based on this one virus, like, it's like that still today, like, the most powerful country in the world, America, can't even, like, come to terms with it or, like, fight it out. Like, it's, like, so interesting, because it's like you're never in control. You think that you have an illusion that you're in control, but it's like, there's always something greater than you that's, like, showing you and, like, guiding you through it. So it's, like, so important.
Yeah, absolutely. So wanted to get your take on, so sort of circling around a little bit here, but I think it comes back. So we talked about what you loved about Somali culture. We talked about how you kind of navigate your worldview in the midst of all the worldviews, in the midst of all the cultures you have to navigate. Mm-hmm. One thing you were talking about on the podcast that I found really interesting is you were talking about how the Somali culture having these very, very high rigorous expectations for women, but that not existing for men. What do you think is going on there?
Also, I think that culture might be for in Somalia as well, but I think in the diaspora, it's, like, so weird because, like, young girls are raised to be wise, but also as students at the same time. They're like working and stuff like that. So it's like, I see a lot of households where girls are like washing the dishes, like helping their family cook, like, you know, doing all these extra activities, taking care of their younger siblings, doing school. So they're able to navigate and like they get great grades, and their boys are just told to be them, like, just have fun. A lot of times, like, you'll see young Somali men, like, who are not graduating high school, for instance, and who are not, like, you know, doing as well as the girls are. And then, like, there's all this dialogue to understand, like, why are our boys the way they are? But it's like, you're not raising them to be men, you're just raising them to be trash, in my instance. So, yeah, I think that, like, as I got older, I realized how sexist the Somali culture is, which isn't a surprise because Somalia was colonized by, like, three different, you know, European countries. Like, it was constantly, like, one thing, so it's like, I'm not surprised that they got a lot of that culture from this place. And, like, there's so much examples in history of it, but, like, there's, like, just so many red flags for me in the Somali culture when it comes to some things, or, like, the way things are said. I'm always, like, why do we think that? Like, why do we say this is it? And I always, like, ask, and, like, I come to terms with it, which is why I'm, like, so happy I have Islam, because a lot of things that are normalized in Somali culture is not allowed in Islam. So, like, the concept of raising your son and daughter differently and, like, letting your daughter struggle and constantly, like, you know, like, yeah, almost, like, not have a childhood and letting your son do it, it's, like, not allowed in Islam. Like, there was a hadith where the Prophet was with this man, and, like, his daughter came, and the guide saw her sit on the floor, and then his son came, he, like, picked him up and, like, let him sit in his lap, and the Prophet was like, why don't you do that for your daughter? And the guy was like, oh, and the Prophet was like, you need to treat your daughter and your son equally. And I think a lot of times in some like communities, you don't do that. And they try to justify why, like, there's always an excuse. Even with my mom, I always, when I come at her with the facts, I'm like, no, hold on, what you're doing. She's like, okay, I'll change, I'll stop, you know, I'll figure it out, I'll, like, change. But it's, like, it's normalized. It's, like, okay for, you know, daughters to constantly be working, daughters to be constantly, like, doing, like, two loads of the men. And then for the society to now look back and be, like, why are men the way they are? Like, you know, why are they not, like, actually, like, changing the world, or, like, you know, being, like, our girls? Like, even at UW, like, I feel like every one Somali dude at UW is, like, 10 Somali girls. Like, the girls are always exceeding. And I think it's because of how we're brought up.
So this may sound a little outlandish, and it may be a little kind of wrong, right? But I wonder, again, not knowing a ton about this, but Somalia has been through a lot of conflict in the last, what, 30 years?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the life of men there has been one of fighting, right? That the kind of archetype that men idealize is a kind of warrior archetype. And so if you're a woman who's in that culture, and the things that you've been taught are looking after a home, but also working hard at education, because you're expecting the men to be at war somewhere.
Yeah.
Whereas men are told, whether you're a soldier or not, right? The idea of greatness is conquest. It's battle. Mm-hmm. It's heroics on the battlefield. So if you take those two people, mm-hmm. and you put a woman for out of Somali culture to American culture or any other culture, the tools that woman has are pretty much useful in any context anywhere, yeah. right? So they'll immediately kind of rise to the top where they are.
Yeah.
But if you take somebody who's a warrior, and this happens with people who are war veterans as well, that it's difficult for them to thrive in a context outside of war. And so you see a lot of veterans from militaries all around the world, they get out of a conflict zone and they don't know, and they don't have any examples of how to live in the civilian world anymore. And it's difficult to thrive. And I wonder if that plays into it.
Sorry, Mr. Clause, I'm just letting her know that I'm on a call. But I think the examples I'm giving, the men that I'm talking about, they're born and raised in the West. So it's like, they never really dealt with any war like mentality. But I do think that, like, I think that the way we're raising Somali women, Somali young Somali girls, it's sad, but I think that in the American context it's important, because as a black woman you have to work twice as hard and that you can't compare yourself to any man because, like, it's a male-dominated industry in every aspect, American-wise. Like, I think that, like, you know, if you look at the workforce, like, if you want to be a girl in STEM, like, you know, you're a minority and minority and minority. So it's, like, it's important to have, I think, the skills of understanding that, like, the world's against you and to be raised in that matter. But it's hard because, like, you kind of don't have the childhood a lot of times. Like, a lot of girls, like, struggle to, like, grasp their upbringings, to grasp why, you know, their parents love their brother, quote unquote, more than them. And I think, like, mentally that's, like, draining. But, like, I wish that, like, maybe, like, culturally, like, it was a different, like, justification on why they did it. Because I feel like, you know, so my parent right now is raising their daughters the way they are, thinking about, oh, America's effed up, like, you're gonna have to look twice as hard already, so I'm already teaching the schools to do so. It's more of just, it's just stuck on, which means culture in Somali. And I think that it's important that we recognize that our culture is sexist and that we need to dismantle and get rid of the aspects of it that harm us. Because I think that although in the long run girls are doing better, but there are some girls who are not doing good because of the culture they're brought up to. So I think it's important that we recognize that as well.
Right. So it's almost like you're saying that it's like the sexist culture in Somalia has almost like an unfairly high standard for women, but it hurts the men there because mm-hmm. you have a low standard for them and mm-hmm. they're not given expectations, so they don't grow as much as they should and they're struggling. Yeah.
I think it's like, I honestly think it's God teaching Somalis a lesson. It's like Somalis just thought that, you know, they're being easy on their men so they can enjoy, you know, be great men. And God was like, no. Like, I think that, like, a lot of boys being, you know, sadly in the system or, like, not graduating high school, not really getting into college, it shows that whatever Somali society is doing is not working and that we need to change it. And I think that people are just not taking the signs. Like, there's always, like, meetings and dialogue to better understand why our men are the way they are. And I think a lot of times we overlook their upbringing. I think we try to blame everything but ourselves. I think that's immigrant culture. Like, it pisses me off the hell out. A lot of immigrant parents try to blame the society, try to blame the neighborhood, try to blame the school system, try to blame all these things, but you're doing nothing but holding yourself accountable on how you played a part. And I'm not trying to come out parents, I'm not a parent, but, like, I'm sorry, bro. Like, you should check out what did you do wrong. I get it. The world's effed up. You probably got impacted, you know, impacted by those things, but what could have you done different to make their lives better? And I think it's important for kids to, like, grow up having responsibilities and stuff. Like, I find it weird that, like, somebody was just chilling doing nothing and, like, they feel like there's nothing. Like, it's just weird. Like, whenever I talk to my Somali guy friends and then I talk to my Somali friends for girls, it's like two different things. Like, Somali girls are always, like, doing big things, doing rad things, they're always thinking super highly of themselves and, like, highly of the world, what impact they can make in the world, and, like, so the boys are just there. Like, it's just, they're there. It's like, what are you gonna do? Change the world? That, like, that's too high of a conversation for them. So I think it's weird. And I think it's a sad consequences of a sexist culture. And I think that even, like, I think now in American culture we're kind of seeing that too. Like, a lot of universities are having more girls than guys attend and stuff like that. But it's a man's world. So I think that sometimes, like, even though a man's a bum, he could still make it. And that society still makes excuses for why he's a bum and, like, will allow him to succeed. Whereas, like, you know, as a Black woman, I have to work twice as hard, and I know that. So I can't be a bum in any aspect of my life because it will harm me.
So I'm curious. Let's say you had a son at some point in the future. What do you think you'd do differently if you're the mother of a young man?
Mm-hmm. I think I started doing it with my two younger brothers. So I think that, like, it's important to raise young men as feminists. Because I think a lot of times we see, like, leaders like Trump or Boris Johnson, and we always, like, wonder why they're so sexist and why they're this and that. But I think we forget that because they grew up in a society that allowed them to think their way they're thinking. So, like, for me, for my younger brothers, I'm constantly telling them, like, you know, you're not stronger than me because you're a boy. You know, you're not stronger than this girl because you're a girl. Or, like, the little weird things of society teach them, like, oh, you're a man, you can't cry, and all these, like, effed up things, like, women cry, and I'm always, like, everybody cries, or, like, I was kind of proud a couple of weeks ago, because my community was having their Me Too movement, which a lot of girls were coming out and talking about the sexual abuse and the sexual assault they were facing, And my brother, who's 15, came up to me and he was like, yeah, I blocked all these men because, you know, I know the harm that they did to these survivors. I will not be, you know, in contact with them. And I was like, wow. And I was like, you know, he didn't even like question the survivors, whereas a lot of men say, oh, maybe she's lying. So like just removing those little things that like society normalizes, I think I would raise my son just like I would raise my daughter, like he has chores to do, but I'm going to raise him to understand that he has a level of privilege and that like as a man, he doesn't ever have to fear, you know, at times, well, he is a black man, but like he doesn't ever have to fear walking outside and like somebody's going to, God forbid, do something harmful to him or like, you know, all these things that like understanding, helping him understand the leverages he has and how he can help the people who are, have the other side of the spectrum. I kind of started doing that with my brothers. It's kind of hard though, because like, obviously like my parents, I always like, you're doing too much, or young, they shouldn't be having these type of conversations, I'm too young. But I'm like, it's important for them to be raised as feminists and to be constantly seeing that women are human, even if they're not your wives or your sisters or your friends. Like, I think a lot of times there's guys who just like always like make women's life hell, and the moment you say, oh, that could have been your mom, they're like, oh wow, you're right, I'm so sorry. But it's like, I have to constantly justify a woman's life by saying that she could have been your wife, she could have been your sister, she could have been your cousin. I think that's BS. So I think that's how I would raise my son. Again, I don't know, but that's how it starts.
So I'm curious though, because you're talking about kind of feminism, and that can mean several different things, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I have a friend from Saudi who says that, you know, when I'm in Saudi Arabia, I'm a feminist. It's very important to me. And then when I come to America, I'm like, what the hell are you people talking about? Because it's, there's some very different things, because I think sometimes feminism is about, you know, rectifying actual injustices, but then also there is the erasure of distinction between men and women as well. And I just don't think that's possible.
Yeah. I know, for me, like feminism is just like understanding that women have rights and understanding the importance of women's rights, but also like, I think like, I don't know, when I say I'm a feminist, it's just that, like, I think that women can do everything a man can do. Like, I think that, like, yeah, men and women are different, like, biologically, I believe that, but I think sometimes we focus too much on that, and we, like, limit women. Like, it's never, oh, yeah, we're different, it's always, you can't do this. And I think that I would love to erase young girls being raised to believe they can't do something based on their gender, or even, like, abilities. Like, I think that, like, there's so much technology, there's so much ways of doing things. I feel like every child should be raised to believe they could do something, they could do anything, and that shouldn't change because they think, oh, I'm black or I'm Muslim or girl, I can't do this. I think that you can do anything if you put your will, you know, if you do the hard work, you do it. And that's why I think that, like, it's important to be raising a lot. I think it's problematic, but I was reading an article that said, you know, the Prophet was one of the first feminists, because like Saudi, like the Prophet was in like a such a sexist culture that normalized killing women, like all these like effed up things to women, and the Prophet was saying strange things, which wasn't really strange, it was literally just like, let the women live, you know what I mean, like give them their rights and all these things, which I think that Islam has. I think for me, like when I say I'm a feminist, I'm just literally saying the things Islam says, and I want my kids to learn it. And I think a lot of times as Muslims we forget how just our religion is. Like Islam's a religion of social justice, and like as that guy said, like I think if I ever go to Saudi, I would be traumatized, you know, but even for him, it's different, like, you know, it's different communities, because it's like, yeah, you come to America, and you're like, wait, women, you know, do have equal rights, what are you guys talking about? But I think America, we do a good job of painting a brush. If you look at the statistics, if you look at the numbers, like, we definitely have a pay gap issue, we have all these issues, and I think for our society, these are the issues we want to change. And I think, you know, it may not be Saudi level, and I'm happy it's not Saudi level, but we still have effed up ish that we have to change.
Yeah, right. And so I think it goes back, what you're saying kind of goes back to the central issue, is that there's work to do of defining the central, you know, the rights and the wrongs of life, and being able to take a look at those source materials, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about, the argument between yourself and somebody who is a, you know, say somebody who'd be Muslim and not a feminist, that you're going to be able to pick very specific stories out of the source materials and say, okay, look at this way Muhammad treats Khadija, look at the position Aisha is able to have, look at this. And Aisha, by the way, is such a, I wish there was like a TV series about her. She's one of the most fascinating women in history. But right, you've got all these stories you can kind of pull on to kind of say, okay, well, look at this. Whereas someone else with a differing view is going to be able to pull on a whole range of additional material to be able to say, well, no, actually look at this. Look at the, you know, one man, four wives, look at two women in court for every man, right? All these things. Yeah. And you've got to find a way to be able to navigate that stuff and figure out what is true and what isn't true.
Yeah. And I think that like that work has been done though. So I think it's important for the people to access that work. Cause I think like a lot of Islamophobes like try to nitpick Islam, and I find that bullshit. Especially like, I'm not trying to come at Christians. If you're Islamophobe who's a Christian, and I could do the same thing to your religion. Like, you know, like people have like ruined the world based on colonization, all these other things using Christianity. So I find it weird when people try to do the same thing to Islam. But like, yeah, you're right. You can easily nitpick, but I think the central theme that you can see in the Prophet's life in Islam is that like, it's so just and it's for women rights. Like, I think it's harder to nitpick the stories against that narrative. Like, there's just so much hadith. There's so much, you know, so there's so much things. Like, I think that like, there's a reason why in the 21st century they try to have the narrative that Islam is, you know, unjust to women. Because like, if you look at history, they can't really do that because like the first university was founded by a Muslim woman, like in Egypt, your people, the British, when they came in, they were super uncomfortable seeing women, you know, being doctors, teachers. They were like, what's going on? Y'all need to go back home. So it was like, if you look at history, like Islam was always like, you know, for women, like women were able to live free and stuff like that. But in the Western knowledge, that was a lot. And then now it's kind of like, it's a switch. So like in the Muslim world, they're living, like they're treating women really bad and stuff like that. And in the Western world, quote unquote, women are, you know, freed and all these things. So it's like almost a 360 switch. I just find it weird. But for me, it's like, obviously I live in the West, alhamdulillah, and like, I'm able to have a lot of privileges that other women in the world might not have. I'm aware of those privileges, but I think it's important that like we are aware of it and we like engage in dialogue and like figure out how can we change the world anywhere we live for the better, because I think it's so sad in like 2020 women are asking to be humanized and like asking for basic generic rights such as like, and I just like, it pisses me off. Like sometimes like when, that's why I don't engage in conversation like this, because like when I think about it, it's like, wow. Like yesterday I was listening to a podcast and they were talking about, it was a British culture, it was a British podcast. They were talking about like Black people, like the racism they face. And I was like, it's so sad that in 2020, Black people have to just be like, bro, like, let me be me. Like, it's just weird to me. And same thing for women. I think that like, the fact that like, there's like sexist shift, like sexist passes and just like, how do you go to sleep at night? Like, how do you go to sleep at night knowing that you're not doing what God sent you to do in the world? So it's just funny as well.
But that's precisely the issue though, right? It's that we got to figure out what God has actually sent us to do.
Yeah.
Because something like equality, right, is not something that you get from evidence necessarily, right? Equality is something that you fundamentally believe. Yeah. So to be able to think, okay, the old man, the young woman, the newborn baby, the person with disabilities who will have vastly different contributions to the world are all equal. That has to come from what we fundamentally believe in rather than observing the world. So if you have our inner nature is to be tribalistic, that we look after our people and ignore other people. So you've actually got to have a really strong worldview force to be able to push against what's in your nature to say, no, actually, everybody from every nation is made in the image and likeness of God and have innate worth and dignity and equality based on what they've been given, right?
Yeah.
Equality comes from a supernatural worldview. It's not something you can just arrive at by math.
It's hard. I think that I definitely get it. It's like super hard because like, if you go to anywhere in the world, there's a different view on equality. There's a different view on equity. and it's like super hard, but I think it's important for us to normalize having conversation around it and understand why we think the way we think and like, you know, what, like, I think the biggest issue is for me that we don't engage in enough dialogue and enough conversation to get closer to the answers, if that makes sense. I think that, like I said in the beginning, like, we just let the media dictate when we have conversations about some issues, but they're going on in our communities every day. So I think it's important that, like, we come to terms with some things and come more in the middle. Because right now, I think that we're super, like, people are either to the left or to the right, and there's a few of us in the middle trying to figure out when the party's going to come to the middle, because there's nobody in the middle. So I just wish as a society, as the world, like, we have more dialogue. Like, I wish, you know, the Christian community, like, at church, it would be, like, you know, more dialogue. I think now it does, but, like, even in the Muslim community, I wish we talked about a lot of the issues going on in the world, not when it's a hot topic. You know what I mean? Like, it's weird that, like, we only talk about interfaith dialogue when, God forbid, something happens to a church or something happens to a mosque. It's like, oh, all the churches are in the mosque are running to each other. They're trying to harmonize. They're trying to figure it out. But it's like, this is supposed to happen at least monthly. You know, at least, like, once in a while. Like, we're supposed to be talking to each other all the time. Like, why do we only talk to each other when shit goes left? Like,
yeah. Well, this is the perfect segue out, because the Almighty Initiative, our next event is Saturday, July 18th at 2 p.m. It's going to be North. We're kind of having a bake-off, yeah, and we're trying to get Muslims and Christians together, and we're trying to do an event every month, God willing, depending on how the Rona goes. So anyone who's in Seattle, come to that. But
yes, come. That's amazing.
Now let me see, make sure I can pronounce this right. Ahlam?
Yes, Ahlam. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much for being on the show today. And thank you guys for listening to the Almighty Initiative podcast. We will be back next week.